Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 to 15, and can be found on page 59 in the church Bibles. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, "I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up." When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, "Moses, Moses." And Moses said, "Here I am." "Do not come any closer," God said. "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground." Then he said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, "I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them out of that land into a good and spacious land, land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" And God said, "I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain." Moses said to God, "Suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' Then what shall I tell them?" God said to Moses, "I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites: 'I am has sent me to you.'" God also said to Moses, "Say to the Israelites, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, the name by which I am to be remembered from generation to generation.'" This is the word of the Lord.
Shall we pray? May the words of my lips and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our Saviour and our Redeemer. Amen. So, today it's the calling of Moses. And this is a very well-known story. I'm sure if, as a child, you had a picture Bible, this is very likely to have been one of the stories that was shown in it, because it's a very dramatic story that really grabs our imagination. So we're going to have a think about what the calling of Moses meant and what it says about God and what that might therefore say about us and our relationship with God and our lives. But before I look at the passage that we've just had read, there are a few things that I'd like to go over from what precedes this. I know we've already had two sermons about Moses, his early life, but there's just a little bit of background that I'd like to give before we go into the passage, so bear with me. A couple of weeks ago, I was listening to the radio and there was a man telling a story about something that had happened to him in his family. And he was talking about how his father, who had brought him up, he had very recently discovered that that father was not actually his biological father. And that had been a great big family secret. It turned out that pretty much all of his family knew, apart from him. So you can imagine how devastating that must have been for him as a grown man to discover that kind of lie that had been led by people that he loved. But at one point, the interviewer said to him, "So if the man who brought you up, that you always believed was your father, was a good father, and if you got on well and you feel that he gave you a good start in life, is it really necessary to try and get in touch with your biological father?" Because that's what he was talking about wanting to do. And the man used a word in response that I found really powerful, and that he said, "The need within me to get in touch with my biological father is visceral." He said, "It's so deep. It's not something that I can control. It's something that I feel I just have to do. It kind of has power over me, if you like." I don't know whether you've ever seen an episode of Long Lost Family on ITV, if you've ever watched that. It's a programme where people, usually grown-ups, who've been adopted, trace their adoptive family. I defy you to watch that without needing at least half a box of tissues with you. It's very, very moving programme. But there's that, and also Who Do You Think You Are? You may well have seen that, where celebrities trace their past. And just from seeing those kind of experiences, it's so clear how as human beings we have this need, this visceral need for connection with our roots and with the people who have brought us up. We need that sense of connection. Having heard the last two sermons about Moses' early life, something that really hit me was Moses' own family background. To say that it is complicated is a massive understatement, and if you've been here for the last two sermons, you'll probably remember the confusion of his life. It was not in any way conventional. Now, I don't want to go over everything again that's already been said, but just a very quick recap. Moses was born into a situation of absolute, to say it was dangerous is obviously an understatement, because Pharaoh, who was in charge of Egypt at the time, had given this law to say that all Hebrew Israelite boy babies were to be immediately murdered by being thrown into the Nile. And we know that Moses' family saved him from that and kept him safe. And then he is saved by the person who should actually be the arch enemy. He's saved by Pharaoh's own daughter. And I know that Rob has pointed out the absolute irony of that in itself. But you know what? There are the seeds of the story that unfolds throughout the whole Bible and culminates in the death and resurrection of Jesus, right here in this little bit of the story in Exodus. Because the fact that it's Pharaoh's daughter that saves Moses says that we are talking about a God who can turn death into life, who can turn hate into love, who can take our most painful and challenging experiences and turn them into something which is life-giving. These are the seeds of the story of salvation that we eventually see in the resurrection of Jesus. This is where it begins in the Bible. But to go back to Moses and his upbringing, of course he is an Israelite, but he's brought up as an Egyptian. It's likely, from reading between the lines, that he knew that he was an Israelite, but he would have had to hide all of that part of himself, because if he didn't, it probably would have been this. So he would have lived with the tension of that identity crisis within him. Who am I? Am I Egyptian or am I Israelite? which way does it go? And there's a very poignant verse in chapter 2, where we're told that the young Moses, it's in chapter 2, verse 11, it says, "One day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labour." Now, it might be easy to miss that, but stop and think about that for a moment. Here he is, an Israelite, dressed as an Egyptian, surrounded by Egyptians, appearing like an Egyptian, who has to stand there and watch the people that he knows are his, being persecuted by the enemy that he is part of. I mean, can you imagine what that must have been doing to him inside? And in a way, it's no surprise that that sense of dislocation and anger must have been building up and building up in him like a volcano. And the point where it erupts is what we see in chapter 2, where he ends up murdering an Egyptian who he sees beating an Israelite. So it's not to say that it was right for him to murder the Egyptian, but it's just that moment where he's just, I can't hold this in anymore that I've been trying to repress all this time. So it's a very, very complicated situation that he's living with. And then when he goes on to get married, he marries an Israelite woman. And there's a very telling little detail in chapter 2. The moment where he meets Zipporah, that's the woman that he marries, after she's first met him, her and her sisters go back to their father and they talk about Moses and they say, "We met an Egyptian." He's seen as an Egyptian, so his own people don't see him as one of them at all. And when Zipporah and Moses have their first child, he's given the name Gershon. This is in chapter 2:22. Gershon means an alien in a foreign land. I mean, there's a lot of details here, aren't there, to show that this is someone who has an enormous amount of pain and struggle with his identity in his own personal history. And I'm guessing that if you've lived with that, you probably haven't grown up to be somebody who is very comfortable in your own skin. Maybe he did. But I think circumstances might suggest that he didn't, and he may well have been someone that really lacked confidence. Just to mention, again, that sense of him having to witness his own people being persecuted. It's not that difficult to think of groups of people who have been persecuted in the world in recent history. The obvious one that probably springs to mind would be the Jews during the Holocaust. Or if we bring it up a little bit nearer to where we are now, maybe on a slightly different scale, but Black Lives Matter in America. That's another sense of people being persecuted. We could even talk about the Me Too campaign and a lot of things that have happened recently. Some of us may well know what that feels like, to have a sense of injustice, a feeling that your own people are being oppressed. And one of the key things about that feeling is the utter sense of powerlessness, feeling there is nothing I can do to change this or make it any different, which is probably what Moses was experiencing. But if we look at the very end of chapter 2, it's very clear that Moses experienced that, but all of the Israelites were feeling the weight of that oppression of being slaves. And at the very end of the chapter 2, we get this. The Israelites groaned in their slavery. Their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. Often when we are in that situation of feeling oppressed and feeling powerless, the only place we can go is to look up. Because human beings are making such a mess of it all, quite frankly. It's a really instinctive thing, if you're a person of faith, to appeal to God. Oh God, save us and help us out of this mess. That's exactly what the Israelites do. And the very last verse of chapter 2, I think is really beautiful. It just has these words. God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. He is there, he is watching, and he does care. And that's where the cliffhanger leaves us at the end of chapter 2. And so now we go into this story of the calling of Moses, this very dramatic story. So, what is God going to do? How is he going to save the Israelites? Well, the first thing he does, as we already know, is that he appoints a leader. If you stop for a minute and think about people that have been very successful and good leaders, we probably think of all different kinds of qualities. But I was thinking about people that have been very successful military leaders and very powerful, not necessarily good in a moral sense, but somebody like Napoleon. I mean, he was a complete tyrant, but you could say that he was a good military leader on one level. And if we're thinking on that level, I suppose Winston Churchill is an obvious person to think of here as somebody that was powerful and strong and brought success, won. But a lot of those successful leaders would have in common the fact that they were strong and confident people. And they would almost certainly have been leaders that were part of the community that they were leading, the people that had come out of that community. So is that the sort of person that God chooses to lead the Israelites out of slavery? No, it's not, because God never does things in the way that we expect him to. God has chosen somebody that has all of the complexity of the background that Moses does. For starters, he's picked somebody who is wanted for murder by the Egyptians. That's a bit tricky. He's picked somebody who almost certainly would not have felt confident about standing in front of a people who may not even consider him to be one of them, and say, I'm going to lead you now. And then having to face the Egyptians who had brought him up and had created, in a sense, the awfulness of his life story that he had to cope with. It's a very, very unlikely idea of God's. Added to that also is the fact that Moses wasn't brought up as an Israelite, so he wouldn't have had maybe all of the religious background that the Israelites would have had. And of course, we're talking about the ancient world here. So a lot of people in the ancient world believed in multiple gods, particularly the Egyptians, who Moses had been brought up as. So he may well have had a real confusion in his mind about who God was. The idea of there just being one God might have been quite a difficult concept for him to take on board. So it's pretty unlikely. One thing that particularly struck me as well about this encounter of Moses meeting God in the burning bush in the wilderness is the fact that this really powerful encounter does not happen in the middle of an act of worship. I guess when we come to worship, probably most of us are expecting to meet with God, and that's completely normal. That's why we do it. That's why we're here. But isn't it interesting that this extremely powerful encounter with God comes not in an act of worship, but right in the middle of a very mundane daily life experience? He's just out there tending the sheep. There's an obvious link there, isn't there, for our own life. Could it be possible that our most powerful encounters with God could actually come in the midst of the humdrum of our daily lives? Maybe for some of you, you might be conscious of that happening. God is always with us. It's just that very often, in the busyness of what we do in our daily lives, we're not always tuned into that, and we're not always thinking about it. But I know I've mentioned it before, but something that's such a helpful little exercise, just to help you be conscious of where God has been in your daily life. It's the Ignatian prayer exercise before you go to sleep at night. Rerun, very briefly, your day. And anywhere where you notice something positive that happened, remind yourself, that was God with me today. I didn't notice it at the time, but now I can see that was God. And in the same token as well, it's also about noticing not just the positive things, but things that might have drained us, or things that we might have really found difficult or challenging. And just noticing those moments and thinking, where might God have been in those encounters today? And if we don't know, we just leave those things with God at the end of our day. And it can just help us to become more conscious of his constant presence with us. But there's also the other way of looking at God in our everyday lives. It's that thing of life is to be lived forwards, but is to be understood backwards. You might well be familiar with that kind of way of looking at life. There's just a little story from my own life that I think I may well have told before in a sermon here. I've reached that stage of repeating anecdotes, so please forgive me if you think, heard it, but it just really illustrates this point. But when I was 18, I spent a year living in the depths of the French countryside with a family being an au pair, which was really wonderful in many ways, but incredibly challenging in others. And the family were lovely, but just the experience of isolation was something that I found very, very difficult. But during that year, by some means, somebody put me in touch with a really lovely family that lived in the area. And the mother of the family was an English teacher in a local secondary school. And she had two daughters that were about my age. And because I didn't work at all at weekends, that family came and they collected me and they took me back to their house. And every weekend I spent with them. And they took me to visit the local area, to visit different parts of France. Honestly, they were a bit of a lifeline during what was quite a challenging year for me. They weren't practicing Christians. But you know, when I look back on that experience, I am absolutely convinced that that was God meeting me in my wilderness, as God met Moses in the middle of his wilderness. And I only really could see that by looking back on it. I couldn't see it at the time. So he can work in our daily lives in the most unexpected of ways. And it's just about asking him, oh God, open my eyes so I can see you. I can see you in my daily life. I just want to read a couple of sentences from a commentary that I thought I can't put that better. So I'll just read what it said, which is all on this subject. Moses' divine encounter with God comes with no time to spare. God's people are in trouble. God has seen it. God knows it. God must act. And he does it by appearing in a bush, on a mountain, in the back of beyond, to a man wanted for murder, no less. God likes to show up in the wilderness, right where we least expect it, and right where and when we need it most. Another little detail I noticed about this encounter between God and Moses is quite simply the immense compassion of God. The immense compassion that he has for Moses and also, by extension, for our lives. After the introductions have happened and God has told Moses who he is from the midst of the burning bush, one of the first things he says comes in verse 7. He says to Moses, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. Think back for a moment to that young man dressed as an Egyptian, but inside being an Israelite who stood and watched the Egyptians beating up the people that he knew were his own people. How do you think it might feel for Moses to hear the voice of this all-powerful God saying to him, "Moses, I see their suffering too, and I really care about them. Everything you have felt is valid." I would imagine that that was an immensely affirming experience for Moses to know that God understands all of that stuff he's been feeling for so many years. And God's going to change it. He's going to make a difference. That positivity. By extension, for us, I think it's important to say that there is no issue in our lives or in the world which troubles us, which is too small for God to care about. We're living in quite troubled times, aren't we, at the moment? It does feel like there's a lot of uncertainty around, and it can be very easy to feel a bit despairing about that. But I don't know about you, sometimes I think to myself, oh, you know, for goodness sake, we're not on the level of Syria or Yemen or somewhere where it's really, really serious. Almost as if I don't have the right to feel worried about what's happening. But I think God actually says, you know, if you're concerned about this, I'm concerned about it too. And I'm right there with you. And that also, remember where the story ends. This is all about a God of resurrection. So I think there's enormous hope in this encounter with God that we can take for ourselves today in anything that we might be facing, whatever it might be that troubles us. And now in the story comes the big whammy. It's the calling. This is what I want you to do with your life, Moses, moment. Verse 10. God ends that paragraph with, "So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." Oh gosh, how ridiculous must that have sounded to Moses with everything that he's been through. Sense of dislocation and being a misfit and all of that stuff, being wanted for murder, all of it. And now he's being asked to go back to those people and plead for the Israelites to be released. It's no surprise at all that Moses reacts in, shall we say, not the most confident way of all. Verse 11, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt?" Well, that's a fairly obvious response in a way. But, you know, it's very interesting that in calling stories in the Bible, nearly always the first reaction of the person being called is, "No thanks, God." Remember Jonah? He actually physically runs in the opposite direction to where he's been asked to go. So that's a fairly common reaction to being called. But actually, when you stop and think a bit more logically about it, there is quite a lot of sense in God calling Moses particularly to this role. Because he is somebody, probably the only person, that could make that unique bridge between the Israelites and the Egyptians, because he is, in a sense, part of both communities. If it was just an Israelite that stood in front of Pharaoh, well, maybe he wouldn't have listened at all. But the fact that this is an Israelite who's been brought up as an Egyptian, maybe I've got a bit of a connection here. So it's not completely crazy. And in fact, we could well say it's as if the whole of Moses' life has been leading to this point. All of that suffering and all of that confusion, finally, is going to be put to something which is life-giving. Isn't that amazing? And of course, there is the link into our own lives, that we do have a God who has the capacity to take our struggles and our confusion and our difficulties and turn them into something which is life-giving. I don't want to be glib about this. I'm not trying to say that people's experiences of suffering are really good and God makes those things happen to people. I believe, actually, that God, those things happen, but then God can take them and turn them round and use them for his purposes. I don't know whether some of you can think of experiences in your own lives which have proved to be something which can be useful and life-giving. When I was growing up, I had a really, really close friend through most of my school life. We became friends when we were about six. I think we were in top juniors, as it was called then. And we were fairly inseparable throughout most of primary school. And we went to secondary school and we were put in the same class. So we carried on being really close friends. And when my friend was 11, a real tragedy struck her life in that her mum died of a brain tumour, and it happened very quickly out of the blue. But that experience almost brought us closer because she was an only child. She didn't have any siblings to share that with. And practically, it meant that after school every night, she had to come to my house until her dad got home from work to collect her. We experienced a lot of those firsts that you do when you're growing up together. You know, we spent most of our teenage friendship talking about pop music and boys and things like that. You know how it is. But when we were 15, we had the most almighty fallout. And to this day, I could not even tell you what that was about or why it happened. It just did. But what I do remember is the effect that that had on me at that time. I can remember standing at the top of the stairs at home and thinking to myself, if I throw myself down these stairs, I might break my arm and then I won't have to go to school and I won't have to see her. It's all very dramatic, isn't it, when you're that age? And I can remember hiding in the toilets at school because I was so scared of going out and having to see her and having a confrontation. And it went on and it went on, and all the adults around us were saying things like, oh, you just need your heads banging together, and really helpful things like that. But actually, you know, we didn't really. It wasn't particularly reconciled. And I left school and she stayed at school, and we had a few years apart. But then when I was a student, I think the thing about time healing, it had healed a bit. I felt the time was right to call her, so I picked up the phone and I called her, and we had a really nice conversation, and we kind of became friends again, and I'm still friends with her today. But it was never again on the intense level that it had been when we were growing up. But during that really, really difficult time, I can remember saying, oh God, please just make this better. Please just make us be friends again. I'll do anything. I can remember really almost crying out to God, you know, the higher power. I don't know what else to do. Just please help me. But God didn't answer that prayer. He allowed that relationship to go in the direction that it went in. But, you know, all these years later, the kind of vocation that I have now, it does often involve working with people who have broken relationships. And lo and behold, I've ended up working in a school with teenage girls who very often have those enormous fallouts. And I know now that as an adult, it's not helpful to say, come on, just get over it and be nice to each other. When you're a teenager, those feelings are so intense. It's very, very real. So even though that experience was awful at the time, it's something which I do honestly think that God has really used to help me have more understanding of other people's pain. Although, you know, mine was at a much lesser degree than some of the things I deal with. But that story has become life-giving in the very great long scheme of life. So that's just an example of God taking our pain and our suffering and turning it into something which can be beautiful, as he has just done with Moses, or as he's about to do as the story unfolds. We're not quite there yet, but I'm sure we'll see it in the days that come. Oh, there's so much more I could say about this passage, but I'm not going to. I think we need to kind of leave it really soon. But just one thing to finish with. There's this curious part at the end of that passage where we have this thing about God's name. God saying, my name is I am. I am who I am. There's a little poem that someone has written about those verses, and I think it kind of fits in with the theme. So I'm just going to read this poem out, which you may have heard before. I was regretting the past and fearing the future. My Lord spoke. My name is I Am. He paused. I waited. He continued. When you live in the past, with its mistakes and regrets, it is hard. I am not there. My name is not I Was. When you live in the future, with its problems and fears, it is hard. My name is not I Will Be. When you live in this moment, it is not hard. I am here. My name is I Am. When God responds to Moses saying, I can't do this, he gives him just five words. They're in verse 12. I will be with you. I will be with you. That's the only response God gives to Moses' sense of inadequacy and fear. And I think the reason he just gives him that response is because that is enough. Just the knowledge that he is with you. We'll leave it there, and I'd just like to finish with a prayer, so let's pray. Loving God, thank you that just as you were with Moses, you are with us in anything that we face. And your promise is that that is enough. However we might feel this week, help us to remember that we have all the resurrection power of your Spirit with us.